F. Kennedy's death, there is still speculation among his brother's intimates about whether he was aware of any hard fact that might indicate that his crusades against the Cuban dictator, or the underworld, or the Teamsters boss, had backfired against his brother. About whether his grief was intensified by a sense of responsibility, even of guilt, about his brother's death. The fact that this speculation has never stopped is testimony not to any hard fact about his grief, but rather to its unusual depth and duration, and to its effect on the man so many of them worshipped. For those who knew Robert Francis Kennedy well, the men and women who spent a lot of time with him, do not feel that he ever again became his old self. Interview these men and women over and over, and one hears, over and over, the same phrase. He changed. Even to date the change in Kennedy to the assassination may be misleading. It had been during the Cuban Missile Crisis a year earlier that the men sitting around the cabinet table had seen the once simplistic Robert Kennedy behave quite differently. But now, after the assassination, the evolution from Kennedy's old Manichaean black-and-white view of life became suddenly much more noticeable. "It's an impressive thing now how well he grasps the gray areas," an old ally said. When, not long into the Johnson administration, four Cuban fishing boats were seized just 2 miles off the Florida Keys, Hawks, in a National Security Council meeting, wanted Johnson to view the incursion as a test of the new president, one that must be met by a show of force. Bobby advised viewing it instead as a mistake, like a speeding parking ticket. Just tell them to get out of there and go home. If you want to fine them a couple of $100, fine them. But the idea of locking them up and creating a major crisis about it was foolish. The fishermen were fined and sent home. In other respects, too, the change was more the continuation of an evolution. The hints that there had always existed, beneath the rudeness, the anger, the belligerence, the mean streak, the cruel streak, beneath the bottle over a student's head in the Cambridge bar and the abandonment of a friend on a boat he couldn't sail, the hints that there had always been very different qualities in Robert Kennedy had always been just that, hints. Although Vandenhoevel, who went to work for him in 1955, says, "There was always something very vulnerable about Bobby. Before November 22nd, there had been few signs of an awareness in Robert Kennedy that he himself might not be immune to the storms and terrors of life. Shielded by his father's wealth and calloused by his father's philosophy, and thrust at an early age into the roles of prosecutor and political campaign manager, he had lived a professional life more aptly described by the detested adjective ruthless than by the one Vandenhoevel chooses. If there was an awareness within him of, or any empathy for, the vulnerability of less protected human beings to the storms and terrors, the signs he displayed of it, tenderness, gentleness, had mostly seemed restricted to members of his family and to children. But now, following his brother's assassination, the hints began to become broader, in scenes that men and women who witnessed them never forgot. About a month after the assassination, he attended the annual Christmas party at a Washington orphanage. Peter Maas, one of his journalist friends, had walked over from Justice with him. The moment he walked into the room at the orphanage, all these little children, screaming and playing, there was just suddenly silence, Maas recalls. Bob stepped into the middle of the room, and just then a little black boy, 6 or 7 years old, suddenly darted forward and stopped in front of him and said, "Your brother's dead. Your brother's dead." The words knifed to the hearts of the adults in the room. "You could hear a pin drop," Maas says. Some of the adults turned away. "There wasn't any place in the world any of us wouldn't have rather been than in that room," he says. The little boy knew he had done something wrong, but he didn't know what, so he started to cry. Were there any words that could be said to him? "You wouldn't have thought so," Maas says. But then Robert Kennedy, picking him up, in kind of one motion, and holding him close, said, "That's all right. I have another brother." There were other hints. Appearing at the dedication of a Catholic home for the aged in Kansas City, Bobby moved through the wards, followed by a throng of television cameras and reporters. Feeling they had enough pictures and quotes, all of them, with the exception of Ben Bradley, then of Newsweek, had left before he walked upstairs to a ward for the terminally ill. He went from bed to bed, rubbing their hands, touching elbows, putting his head to their foreheads, comforting, Bradley was to recount. Then he sat down, alone at the bedside of a woman whose eyes were tight shut, whose death rattle was the only sign of life. And for close to an hour, I watched with tears in my eyes as the ruthless Bobby Kennedy stroked this unknown woman's hand and spoke to her in a near whisper. The gentleness and tenderness, the vulnerability, had always been present in Robert Kennedy, and yet had been subordinated to other conflicting qualities, and hidden, his most tenaciously maintained secret. But now he had had to look at that face that had once been so vibrant and charming, but on which not a good job had been done. How could he not have learned more about vulnerability, realized that no one was invulnerable? How could he not identify more deeply than before with the injured, the wounded of the world, after feeling himself such terrible pain? And, in a way, powerful though he still was, with the powerless of the world as well. His power now, though still considerable, was nothing beside his former power. Much of that had vanished in an instant, in the moment he picked up the phone that day at Hickory Hill and heard J. Edgar Hoover's voice. He was still Attorney General, he noted. I have influence, but the influence is just infinitesimal compared to the influence I had before. After his return from Aspen in January, the deep wellsprings of compassion in Robert Kennedy, always present but heretofore only intermittently visible, began to rise to the surface in the objectives he pursued in government. Some of his old objectives, ends to which he had devoted years of obsessive pursuit, seemed to interest him not at all. In March, a harpoon would sink into Jimmy Hoffa at last. Found guilty of conspiring to fix a jury, the Teamster boss received an 8-year sentence. Bobby sat silent, melancholy, at the Get Hoffa team's celebration. Ken O'Donnell felt he understood. There's nothing to celebrate, he said. He had had enough tragedy of his own now. Several members of the team felt that he was, one says, unhappy that the Teamster boss had received such a long jail term. He didn't like the idea of 8 years, another says. From time to time thereafter he would ask, how's Jimmy doing? Otherwise, he had lost all interest in Hoffa, Murray Kempton was to say. I never heard him say anything about Hoffa that really indicated much more than boredom with the subject in the last years of his life. The same was true of the Mafia. When the telephone rang at Hickory Hill that day, he had just been planning offensives against the underworld with District Attorney Morgenthau. I saw him often after that, but he never mentioned organized crime to me again, Morgenthau says. Those intent on finding clues speculate that the subjects of Hoffa and the underworld were avoided because of an unwillingness to go where the facts might lead. But Kennedy himself had a simpler explanation. I'm tired of chasing people. Even before the assassination, he had begun to take a more active role in the pursuit of social justice rather than of criminals, and it was to social problems such as juvenile delinquency that he turned now. In part, he couched his interest in terms of his brother's legacy, of programs begun but not fulfilled because time had been cut short. Talking in his office with Arthur Schlesinger and Richard Goodwin that December, he explained why he wanted them to stay in their jobs. What's important is what we are trying to do for this country. The thing is, we worked hard to get where we are, and we can't let it all go to waste. My brother barely had a chance to get started, and there's so much now to be done. For the Negroes and the unemployed and school kids and everyone else who is not getting a decent break in our society. This is what counts. The new fellow doesn't get this. He knows all about politics and nothing about human beings. A lot of people in this town didn't come here just to work for John Kennedy, an individual, but for ideas, things we wanted to do. I don't think people should run off. The power of the Kennedy wing of the party, he said, will last for just 11 months, until the election. Until that time, Johnson would need its support to win re-election. After November 5th, we'll all be dead. But until November 5th, he said, they would have enough power so that when I talk to him, I am ready to be tough about what we must have in return for that support. His brother's programs would certainly have passed if he had lived, if they weren't passed during the remaining years of his first term, had he not been killed. They would certainly be passed during his second term. That was the mantra Bobby Kennedy repeated to his brother's men. That was the mantra they would repeat in oral histories and interviews and speeches as long as they lived. That was the mantra they would repeat in books, memoirs, biographies, scores of books. Those who wrote the books that originally influenced history, that set the template for the image of John F. Kennedy that has endured, would be reinforcing it in the books they wrote more than 45 years later. Regardless of the mantra's validity, however, and like so many other issues, it must remain to be evaluated in the last volume of this work, for it is during the course of the years to be covered in that volume that the extent of its validity will become clear. The passion that lay beneath it, Robert Kennedy's passion for social justice, was genuine. With every month that passed after the assassination, his indignation at injustice seemed to rise. Even a newsman like Ben Bradley, whose relations with him had been cool, saw the genuineness, realizing that the scene in the Kansas City home for the aged had been an accurate measure of something significant in Robert Kennedy's character, hidden and largely unrecognized though it had been. In an article he wrote after Robert's assassination in 1968, Bradley said that during the years between the assassinations, "I'd been slowly coming to sense this man's passion, his building rage at the persistent inequalities that plagued America, his readiness to embrace the homeless and enlist in their cause." During those years, Bradley would write, "Bobby Kennedy's almost romantic determination to make a difference had deeply impressed me. There was no need to compare him with JFK, they were so different, except for that last name and that father. JFK was more intellectual, urbane, sophisticated, witty. RFK was more passionate, more daring, more radical." Robert Kennedy's more pragmatic qualities, the ones that had earned him the adjective he so resented, would never disappear. "Anybody who writes that he looks like a choir boy should burn in hell," says a congressman who opposed one of his initiatives in 1967. His evolution would be a gradual one, and it was, at the time of his death at the age of 42, not so complete that the word ruthless would no longer apply. More than one of his intimates feel constrained to point out that the portrait was, thanks to another bullet, never finished. That, as one of them says, "Bobby Kennedy was always a work in progress." Unfinished, though the portrait may have been left, however, its dominant tone had changed. Having said he was tired of chasing people, Bobby Kennedy had stopped chasing them. Was he tired of something else as well? In addition to ruthless, hate was an adjective often applied to him in the past. "Bobby hates like me. When Bobby hates you, you stay hated." But had the hatred for Jimmy Hoffa stayed? Perhaps not. Some people who knew Robert Kennedy well speculate that perhaps the death of his brother, combined with his father's helplessness, had altered that aspect of his character also. Before that, perhaps the father and the brother had been controlling forces in his life, Vanden Heuvel says. Before that, well, you know, the father had said, "Bobby's like me," and up to that point he probably was. After his long talk with him in February, Murray Kempton wrote that Robert Kennedy knew how to hate. He hated on his father's behalf. He grew up to hate on his brother's. But these last weeks that he has endured have now left behind a man we recognize as being unskilled at hating on his own. Examining Robert Kennedy's life following the gunshot in Dallas, it is possible to feel that, with one exception, that might be true. With the exception of Lyndon Johnson. There had been no change in Robert Kennedy's feelings toward him. In conversation with other people, he never called him the president. Whenever, for the rest of his life, all 4.5 years of it, he used the phrase "the president," he was referring to John F. Kennedy. He called the new president Johnson, or Lyndon Johnson, or the new fellow, or this man. He couldn't bear to think of him sitting in his brother's place, a satyr to Hyperion. Some of the remarks he made about him showed a fundamental misunderstanding of his background. "What does he know about people who've got no jobs?" he asked Goodwin not long after the assassination. "Or are uneducated. He's got no feeling for people who are hungry. It's up to us." Johnson's success fed his bitterness. All those things he's doing, poverty, civil rights, they're things we had just begun, he was to say to Goodwin some years later. We just didn't have the time. If for reasons of politics he covered up his feelings in public, he could not always contain them, even when he knew they were being recorded for history, or perhaps because they were being recorded for history. During the spring of 1964, he sat for a series of oral interviews being conducted for the John F. Kennedy Library by sympathetic friends like Arthur Schlesinger and John Bartlow Martin, and in these interviews his feelings poured out. He tried to justify them. There were three or four matters that arose during the period of November 22nd to November 27th or so which made me bitter, unhappy at least, with Lyndon Johnson. Events involving the treatment of Jackie on the plane trip back and all that kind of business. When he lied again and where he treated Jackie, the whole business, very badly. His brother had seen through Johnson, he said. His brother had said to Jackie, talking about him, that Lyndon Johnson was incapable of telling the truth. His brother had often said how lucky he was to have Lyndon Johnson as vice president because otherwise Lyndon Johnson would be majority leader, and Lyndon Johnson would screw him all the time. Lyndon Johnson never would have been loyal to him, so he was very pleased. He was more pleased about having Lyndon Johnson vice president because he was out of the Senate than he was having him as vice president. And his brother's assessment of his vice president had been correct. He was against our policy on Cuba in October of 62. Although I never knew quite what he was for, he was just against it. He was shaking his head, mad. The interviews reveal Robert Kennedy's resentment that an awful lot of things were going on that President Kennedy did that Johnson was getting the credit for, and that Johnson wasn't saying enough that President Kennedy was responsible for. His resentment that columnists like Reston were comparing the two men, and not always favorably, to President Kennedy. I just don't think that they understand it, in their build-up of Lyndon Johnson comparing him to the president. He despised the way Johnson treated subordinates. They're all scared, of course, of Lyndon. He yells at his staff. He treats them just terribly. Very mean. He's a very mean, mean figure. And resented the success of those methods, his ability to eat people up, even people who are considered rather strong figures, Mack Bundy or Bob McNamara. There's nothing left of them. He despised his methods, the way, for example, he made men beg. Ralph Dungan was trying to work out appointments, and Johnson said he wanted to make sure that everybody who was at all interested called him personally and asked him for the person to be appointed so that they would know they'd be personally indebted to him as president. But Robert Kennedy's feelings about Lyndon Johnson went beyond such analysis. It was in one of these interviews that he said, "Our president was a gentleman and a human being. This man is not. He's mean, bitter, vicious, an animal in many ways." As there had been no change in Lyndon Johnson's feelings toward Robert Kennedy. President though he was, fear as well as hatred, was still a component in those feelings. The fear would always be there. Years later, in a conversation during his retirement, he would describe Robert Kennedy's 1968 announcement that he was running for president as "the thing I feared from the first day of my presidency." Robert Kennedy had openly announced his intention to reclaim the throne in memory of his brother. And the American people, swayed by the magic of the name, were dancing in the streets. Even the acclaim that had greeted his own performance after the assassination was soured for him by the "snot-nosed little runt," Johnson said in that conversation. Every day, as soon as I opened the papers or turned on the television, there was something about Bobby Kennedy. Somehow or other, it just didn't seem fair. I'd given 3 years of loyal service to Jack Kennedy. During all that time, I'd willingly stayed in the background. I knew that it was his presidency, not mine. And then Kennedy was killed, and I became the president. But none of this seemed to register with Bobby Kennedy, who acted like he was the custodian of the Kennedy dream, some kind of rightful heir to the throne. It just didn't seem fair. He railed about the game of royal family that was being played. If Bobby Kennedy's name came up even by accident, Ken O'Donnell says, he'd launch into a tirade about what a son of a bitch Bobby Kennedy was. 99% of the things were untrue. And it'd get back to Bobby Kennedy, and Bobby'd say something about Lyndon Johnson. These two men built up this picture of each other which was just incredible. For a time, these feelings, on both sides, not only were kept out of public view, but were layered over when the two men were dealing with each other. Knowing how much he needed continuity, Johnson did what he could to maintain a facade of cordiality with the living personification of the Kennedy legend, the man who had not only been the martyred president's most trusted counselor, but who reminded people of him in the similarity of their accents and gestures. But Lyndon Johnson had the power now. Fortune's reversal could not have been more complete. Two men hated each other to the depths of their beings. For a time, 3 years, one had had power over the other and had used it ruthlessly, used it beyond the bounds of policy, used it to insult and humiliate the other. And then in an instant, in a gunshot, the world of the two men was turned upside down. Suddenly the other man had the power. "You're going to get yours when the time comes," Bobby Kennedy had vowed. And then the time had come, 3 years of it. Now that time was over. The other man's time, the time for vengeance, had not quite arrived. Lyndon Johnson couldn't afford to alienate the Kennedy faction yet. His strategy must still be one of restraint. Conscious though Johnson was of that consideration, however, his feelings about Bobby Kennedy were too strong always to be concealed. He was, furthermore, becoming more secure in the presidency, more euphoric from the adulation he was receiving, less guarded. Passion started to break through strategy's bounds. By late December, shortly before he left for the ranch, the rein he'd kept on himself in his dealings with Bobby was starting to slip. He fired a test shot, announcing that he had appointed Thomas C. Mann, Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, a position from which President Kennedy had removed him because of a belief among Kennedy's Latin American team that Mann was, in Goodwin's words, a colonialist by mentality who believes that the natives, the Latin Americans, need to be shown who is boss, and who had a basic lack of belief in Kennedy's Alliance for Progress. Now Mann would be in effective charge of the alliance, and Goodwin, who wrote in his diary that the appointment had occasioned real gloom among the Kennedy crowd, went to see Bobby in his office at Justice along with Arthur Schlesinger. It was at this meeting that Kennedy said that although our power will last for just 11 months, during these months until Election Day 1964, the power of the Kennedy faction would still be substantial. But that prediction did not survive its first test. The shot he fired back, a letter to Johnson protesting Mann's appointment, went all but unheard. The public wasn't interested in Latin America. While the appointment drew some criticism in the editorial columns of liberal newspapers, it was buried in the wave of adulation for Johnson's successes. "Johnson has won the first round," Schlesinger wrote Bobby. "He has shown his power to move in a field of special concern to the Kennedys without consulting the Kennedys. We have underestimated the power of the presidency. The president has nearly all the cards in this contest. We are weaker, a good deal weaker than we had supposed." Having won the first round, Johnson, after his return from Texas in January, was ready for the second. Trying to rouse Bobby from his apathy, Averell Harriman and McGeorge Bundy suggested that he be sent to Southeast Asia as a presidential envoy to informally mediate a territorial dispute between Indonesia's President Ahmad Sukarno and the fledgling Federation of Malaysia. Unenamored of the idea, which, he complained to Bundy, had been proposed by staff people who weren't thinking about the Johnson interest, Johnson was delaying a decision when the proposal was leaked to the Washington Post. Its editorial, praising the idea as an indication of the president's laudable concern for the Attorney General, left Johnson, still trying to create the illusion of such concern, little choice but to approve. Speaking to Richard Russell, with whom maintenance of the illusion was unnecessary, the president said that at least the mission, seemingly foredoomed to failure, might make Bobby look bad. "I'm going to send Bobby Kennedy to Indonesia and just let him, Sukarno, put it right in his lap. Let him go out there and have a row with Sukarno." The trip turned out to be the opposite of failure, although not for any reason Johnson or Kennedy had foreseen. Kennedy's meeting with Sukarno took place in Tokyo. On a previous visit to that city in 1962, Bobby, speaking at Waseda University, had been heckled ferociously by both left-wing and right-wing students. Informed now by the American embassy that there was insistent urging from students that he speak again, he reluctantly agreed to do so. When he arrived on a rainy day, the auditorium was jammed with students, and 10,000 more were huddled under umbrellas outside to hear him over loudspeakers. And when the professor introducing him said the name Kennedy for the first time, from inside and outside the auditorium, there was a cheer that seemed to go on and on. He spoke without a text, but since he was speaking about his brother, he didn't need one. Tears were in his eyes, and in the eyes of many of the Japanese as he spoke about all the president had hoped to accomplish, Guthman was to recall, about how he was not only president of one nation, he was president of young people around the world. If President Kennedy's life and death and his relationship to all in our age group mean anything, it means we young people must work harder for a better life for all the people in the world, Robert Kennedy said, as the cheering started again. It was a moment to remember, Guthman would recall, and for the first time, he says, Robert Kennedy began to realize the magnitude of admiration for President Kennedy that existed overseas. A few days later at the University of the Philippines, he spoke again. So large was the throng trying to get a glimpse of him that it broke through police lines. I hadn't wanted to go on that trip, but afterwards I was glad I had, he was to tell Kempton. By the time he returned, he had decided, although he had not decided how he would do it, to remain in public service and carry on his brother's work, Guthman says. As a presidential envoy, he had expected to meet with the president alone to give his report, but on his arrival at the White House, he found, as Guthman relates, that the meeting would be less than private, that Kennedy would be required to brief him in front of a room full of congressmen and cabinet officials. Afterwards, he and Johnson each spoke briefly before the television cameras. We are of the unanimous opinion that he carried out his assignment constructively and with real achievement, the president said, so that Johnson got a picture of him and a Kennedy shaking hands, although Kennedy didn't look at him as he did so. Thereafter, the president never discussed the Sukarno-Malaysia controversy with him again, and the State Department showed little interest in his report. He told Theodore H. White that he felt he had been used. As far as his relationship with Johnson was concerned, Guthman says, the episode left Bobby with a bitter taste, as if the taste hadn't been bitter enough already. In February, the rain slipped further, far enough so that words slipped out of Lyndon Johnson, which he had for weeks restrained himself from speaking. He said them to Robert Kennedy in the Oval Office. The two men were arguing over Paul Corbyn. An eccentric, abrasive, loose cannon of a political operative, Corbyn had been useful to the Kennedys during the 1960 campaign as what Guthman euphemistically calls a gutsy political infighter. Thereafter, however, he had proved troublesome because he would do anything President Kennedy wanted, or what Corbyn thought Kennedy wanted, whether or not Kennedy knew what he was doing. And he had been shunted into a low-level position at the Democratic National Committee. Early in February, he appeared in New Hampshire, where the first Democratic presidential primary would be held on March 10th, to organize a write-in vote for Bobby Kennedy. Whether Corbyn was operating on his own or under instructions is unknown. Bobby's closest aides to a man insist it was the former. But Johnson had no doubts. Summoning Kennedy to the Oval Office on February 11th, he told him to have Corbyn fired. Bobby refused. He said he hadn't even known Corbyn was in New Hampshire and that he was a valuable political asset. Johnson said he knew Corbyn was in New Hampshire and that he wanted him out of that state and off the DNC payroll. If he's such a good fellow, you pay him, he said. I know who he's loyal to. Get him out of there. Bobby continued to refuse. I suggested that he find out himself whether Corbyn was actually in New Hampshire. I'm not going to, he told Johnson. He said that Johnson should remember that Corbyn had worked for President Kennedy and that the president had thought highly of his work. And Lyndon Johnson told Bobby Kennedy that his brother wasn't president now. Bobby was to tell friends that Johnson, demanding Corbyn's firing, had said, "Do it. President Kennedy isn't president anymore. I am." Johnson was not to deny expressing that sentiment, recalling it during a recorded telephone conversation later that day with DNC Treasurer McGuire, in only slightly different words. Johnson told McGuire that he, Bobby, said that I must understand that he, Corbin, had worked for the president, Kennedy, and that the president liked the work he did. I said, I know it, Bobby, but I'm president, and I don't like what he's doing, and I don't want him. It was a bitter, mean conversation, Bobby Kennedy was to say. It was the meanest tone that I've ever heard. The February 11th argument between the two men had escalated at one point into a discussion of the Indonesian trip, although not of its substance. In Bobby's recollection, Johnson said, I did you a favor sending you to the Far East. And Bobby had replied, a favor? I don't want you to do any more favors for me, ever. And again, Johnson's own recollection, as he describes the conversation in the call to McGuire, does not contradict the gist of that recollection. I told him, Kennedy, that when the situation arose in Indonesia, that I was anxious to demonstrate my confidence in him, and I showed it by sending him out there. The president added a bit of description designed to show Bobby in what Johnson seems to have felt was a less than manly light. Tears got in his eyes, and he said he's sorry that I sent him to Indonesia only on account of wanting to show confidence in him, Johnson told McGuire. The adding of that note is of a piece with the timbre of Johnson's voice as he says, but I'm president and I don't want him. And it bolsters Bobby's analysis of the conversation's tone and of the word Charles Bartlett, reconstructing it later, used. So savage. And of course Johnson was correct. John Kennedy wasn't president anymore. He was. Corbin was fired. The tone was to get meaner. I'm just like a fox, Lyndon Johnson once boasted. I can see the jugular in any man and go for it, but I always keep myself in rein. I keep myself on a leash, just like you would an animal. The first phrase in that boast was accurate. Lyndon Johnson had always had a gift for finding a person's jugular, his most vulnerable spot, the one in which he could most deeply be hurt. The rest of the boast, however, was not. If he kept himself in rein on a leash, it was a leash that, all through his life, had been frequently unfastened. His ability to hurt had always been combined with a willingness, an eagerness, in fact, to put the ability to use, with a cruelty, a viciousness, a desire to hurt for the sake of hurting. For one of many examples, see The Path to Power, pages 191 to 192. Now his unerring eye had located, beneath the pale mask of Robert Kennedy's grief, the place in which, because of his brother's assassination, Robert Kennedy was most vulnerable. And the leash came off. Johnson told Pierre Salinger, in a remark he obviously intended to get back to Kennedy, that Jack Kennedy's death might have been divine retribution for his participation in assassination plots against other heads of state. Lyndon Johnson said to Pierre Salinger that he wasn't sure but that the assassination of President Kennedy didn't take place in retribution for his participation in the assassinations of Trujillo and President Diem, Robert Kennedy said during an oral history interview in April 1964. Divine retribution. He said that. Then he went on and said that when he was growing up, somebody he knew, who had misbehaved, ran into a tree, hit his head, and became cross-eyed. He said that was God's retribution for people who were bad. God put his mark on them. And that this, President Kennedy's assassination, might very well be God's retribution to President Kennedy for his participation in the assassination of these two people. Although neither of the two assassinations to which Johnson referred had been authorized by the late president, Johnson didn't believe that. Pointing to the picture of President Diem in the Elms the day after Kennedy's funeral, Johnson had told Hubert Humphrey, "We had a hand in killing him. Now it's happening here." In his remark to Salinger, Johnson didn't include the assassination attempts against a third head of state, Fidel Castro, although he was aware that they had occurred and believed that the Kennedys had had a hand in them as well. A week after the assassination, he was asking J. Edgar Hoover whether Oswald was connected with the Cuban operation, Mongoose. His suspicions were soon to harden. By 1965, he was telling an aide, President Kennedy tried to get Castro, but Castro got Kennedy first. During his retirement, he would tell a journalist that the Kennedys had been operating a damn murder ink in the Caribbean. Whether or not his remark to Salinger brought the Castro attempts to Robert Kennedy's mind, the remark was made, as Evan Thomas says, cruelly and with an unerring instinct for Kennedy's hidden vulnerabilities. And the fact that it struck home is testified to by its target. It was, Kennedy told Arthur Schlesinger, the worst thing Johnson has said. Kennedy was to tell a friend that the new president does not know how to use people's talents, to find the very best in them and put the best to work, but more than any other man he knows how to ferret out and use people's weaknesses. He had ferreted out one of Kennedy's. In speaking of Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy had in the past used adjectives like formidable, flawed, and powerful to describe him. Now a new adjective would be added to the description. Schlesinger, summarizing Kennedy's feelings, writes that he saw Johnson more than ever as a formidable but flawed man, powerful but dangerous. Chapter 25. Hammer Blows. Writing in 1964, Theodore H. White would say that the clash of Robert F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson may continue to agitate the Democratic Party for some years to come. That prophecy would prove accurate. Writing in 1997, 33 years after White, Russell Baker would recall that the story of the two men, a story that still makes many an old-timer's blood boil, had poisoned the Democratic Party for most of the 1960s. With each year, in fact, the passions between the two men would blaze only more fiercely. Even the gunshot in Los Angeles in June 1968 couldn't extinguish those passions. As Kennedy lay dying the next evening, Johnson, over dinner in the White House, kept asking Joe Califano, "Is he dead? Is he dead yet?" Califano had to make so many calls to the Secret Service, or to his assistant Larry Levinson, that Levinson finally asked him, "Joe, is this something that he's wishing to have happen? Why is he asking it that way?" "I couldn't tell because Johnson didn't know whether he hoped or feared that the answer would be yes or no," Califano was to recall. After the answer was finally yes, Johnson issued the appropriate public statements, praising Kennedy as a noble and compassionate leader, a good and faithful servant of the people. But he also made a private telephone call to the Secretary of Defense, Clark Clifford, who had jurisdiction over Arlington National Cemetery. The Kennedy family wanted Robert to be buried in Arlington, and Johnson, Clifford was to relate, wanted to discuss whether or not Bobby Kennedy had the right to be buried in Arlington. Stunned and dumbfounded by the call, one of my saddest experiences in dealing with Johnson, Clifford told Johnson, he says, that the regulations were irrelevant and in any case could be suspended by the commander-in-chief, and it seemed obvious that Bobby should be buried near his beloved brother. The politician in Lyndon Johnson understood this, Clifford relates, and Bobby was buried in Arlington near Jack's grave. The feud between the two men, one of the great blood feuds of American political history, would, during most of the 60s, have far-reaching influence, surprising sometimes in its impact not merely on their party but on the course of American history. The story of the feud would have a dozen twists and turns even before the day in March 1968, on which what Johnson had feared from the first day of my presidency came true, and Robert Kennedy announced that he was running against him for the Democratic nomination, moments in which first one man and then the other could feel for a moment, and usually only for a moment, for the battle would quickly be rejoined, the flush of victory over a long-hated foe. But for now, at the end of these first months after Lyndon Johnson became president, the feud had only one victor. If the Tom Mann appointment was indeed the first round, there had also been during these months the Indonesia and Corbyn rounds, and Johnson won all three. In addition, during these months, Johnson had, in his battle with Robert Kennedy, achieved the overall objective he considered most vital. In order to preserve around his administration the aura of continuity he considered of overriding importance, it had been necessary to keep Kennedy in it. And at the end of those months, Kennedy was still in it. He left later, of course, but for Johnson's purposes, he had stayed long enough. After Johnson's return from the ranch, several of the Kennedy men began leaving. Schlesinger declared war, I guess, the day that John F. Kennedy went into the ground, Ralph Dungan was to say. To Johnson, the historian epitomized the intellectual unable to deal with the problems of the real world. Once, confronted with a knotty problem in a foreign country, the president, expressing his contempt, asked, "What do you want me to do, send Schlesinger to take care of things?" The president and Jenkins, who echoed his thoughts, expressed mounting irritation with him. There was something about him which peculiarly roused the Johnsonian ire. And as is clear from the contemporaneous entries Schlesinger made in the journal, the feelings were mutual. Despite admonitions to himself in the journal that "I must guard against my dislike of the current style and corn," the guard was sometimes dropped. The new president's statement to Schlesinger that he didn't have the knowledge, the skills, the understanding of his predecessor was an assessment with which Schlesinger thoroughly agreed, in regard to Johnson's personality and brain power alike. Although the new president is a quick study, unlike JFK, he does not retain what he has been told, he wrote on December 30th. His basic trouble, I imagine, is that he has never in his political career had to concentrate on substance. Policy for Johnson has always been determined by the balance of political pressures. Now he must begin to examine the merits of policy per se, and he is not intellectually or psychologically prepared to do this. The historian's enchantment with the former president wasn't fading. Invited to Jackie Kennedy's Georgetown townhouse that December for a screening of a film on Jack Kennedy, he found it almost unbearable to watch that graceful, witty, incandescent personality. A week later, it snowed in Washington, almost as deep a snow as the inaugural blizzard. It all began on a fiercely cold day 35 months ago. And that was how it was coming to an end. The White House is lovely, ghostly, and alien. My own depression does not abate. He was soon actively advising Robert Kennedy. "I am more and more persuaded that I am for him whatever he wants," Schlesinger wrote, and at dinner parties the barbs of his very sharp tongue were often aimed at Johnson. He signed a contract to write a history of the Kennedy presidency. Johnson heard about all this, of course, and the problem of disengagement was not, in the event, to prove as considerable as Schlesinger had anticipated. By the end of December, the historian was to write, he had been totally isolated. "I have not had a single communication from the president or his staff for the last month. Not a request to do anything, or an invitation to a meeting, or an instruction, or a suggestion." In fact, by December, Johnson had begun recruiting his successor, a distinguished historian and author from Princeton, not Harvard, Eric F. Goldman. Goldman's upcoming appointment had been leaked to the press, and Schlesinger was receiving inquiries about it from journalists. On January 27th, Schlesinger resubmitted the letter of resignation he had written immediately after the assassination. This time, he was to relate, it was accepted with alacrity. Schlesinger's opinion of Johnson was to change drastically. By 1978, he would be writing, "For all his towering ego, his devastating instinct for the weaknesses of others, his unlimited capacity for self-pity, he was at the same time a man of brilliant intelligence, authentic social passion, and deep seriousness." With Sorensen, in Johnson's view, the sharpest tool, he tried hardest. "Johnson tried to be very nice to me, and he was very nice," Sorensen was to say. "He was very, very nice, not only to him, but to my sons," he says. Having brought his three little boys to the White House one day in December, Sorensen left them downstairs in the White House mess while he was in the Oval Office. When Johnson asked after them, Sorensen mentioned they were downstairs. Johnson said, "Let's go down and see them," and chatted with them very nicely for a while. Since in their conversations, on the phone and in person, Sorensen unbent not at all, Johnson did the bending. When, in a telephone call before the November 27th speech to Congress, Johnson said that he rather liked Galbraith's draft, and Sorensen said, "Well, to be frank with you, I didn't," Johnson backtracked so fast, "Well, I didn't think it was any ball of fire, I just thought it was something you could improve on. I read it in about 3 minutes, but I think a much better speech could be written. I'm expecting you to write a better one. But Sorensen laughed over the phone. The insulting cannot fill his shoes line was simply crossed out. During all the discussions between the two men about the speech, it was never mentioned. In the car riding to Capitol Hill to give that speech, Johnson had tried to tell Sorensen that despite the corning up by Fortas and Humphrey, the speech was 90% yours. Sorensen had curtly contradicted him. Johnson had simply laughed to break the tension. And when, a few days later, Katharine Graham urged presidential tolerance for the curtness, Sorensen had been cantankerous to her too, she said, but that was what he did, instead of crying. I think he is going to come around, if you just give him a little love and overlook. Johnson assured her, I'm going to do it. Although, he added, I've done as much as I can and have any pride and self-respect left. A few hours later, Johnson asked Sorensen again to stay. Sorensen didn't reply, and finally Johnson had to ask, Are you with me? Sorensen's only reply was, I'm still here, Mr. President. All that December, the flattery continued. Sorensen became accustomed to hearing the president refer to him as my trusted counselor, even plugging a book he had published some years previously. He was wooing me, in a sense, to stay on, Sorensen knew. At the ranch, as Sorensen was working on his drafts of the State of the Union, Johnson, knowing what he most wanted to hear, found new ways to praise his fallen leader. Well, your man treated me better than I would have treated him if the positions were reversed, he told Sorensen once. But Sorensen's devotion to Jack Kennedy hadn't been ended by the bullets of Dallas. Kennedy had planned to write a book with me after the presidency, he was to say. Now that he was gone, I felt some obligation to write it. When he received an offer from the same editor who had published Profiles in Courage, he accepted it and handed Johnson a letter of resignation that would take effect on February 29th. Protesting violently, Johnson replayed the theme that had worked before. You and I know that he is up there looking down on us and wants us to work together, carrying out his ideals. And he would not want you to leave here, he said, and went on, his speech growing, in Sorensen's recollection, only more saccharine, until he went too far. Once Sorensen got to know him better, Johnson said, Sorensen would discover that he treated his staff as if they were his own children. Yes, I know, Sorensen replied. That was his only reply, and it was made in a quiet tone, but Johnson evidently understood. He accepted the resignation. Pierre Salinger's plumpness, bushy eyebrows, ever-present cigar, and good humor, all of which made people forget that he had once been an award-winning crime reporter and a very tough rackets committee investigator, had, together with an ability to take a joke, made Plucky the butt of a lot of kidding by many of his colleagues in the Kennedy White House. Jack Kennedy's kidding always stopped at a line that left Salinger his dignity, however. With Lyndon Johnson, there was no such line, as became evident over Christmas at the ranch. First, there was the new president's insistence that Salinger wear that outfit, notably unflattering to his portly physique, and then that he mount a horse and trot off on it in front of a battery of photographers, despite the fact that he barely knew how to ride, a performance that moved reporters to dub him Hopalong Salinger. And there followed an incident at the dinner for Ludwig Erhard in the Stonewall Gym. Salinger was vulnerable because in his youth he had been a pianist so proficient that, for a brief time, he had considered a concert career. At Kennedy parties he sometimes played ditties he had composed himself, along with humorous lyrics. Van Cliburn was stepping off the stage after his masterful renditions of Beethoven and Brahms, when a startled Salinger heard Johnson say, Would Mr. Salinger please go to the piano? Turning red, Salinger tried to demur. Do you think it's fair to put me on after Van Cliburn? He asked. But no demurral was accepted. Trying to make the best of the situation, not that any best was really possible, Salinger, trudging up to the stage, said he would play a piece he had written himself, the Palm Beach Waltz, so that no one would realize the wrong notes he was hitting. When he finished, there was a reward, a 10-gallon hat which Johnson presented to him on stage. It was too big. The brim came down over Salinger's eyes. Reporters felt sorry for Pierre Salinger that day, one of them was to recall. Those who were his friends felt sorry for him during the entire Texas trip. For all his striped shirts and big cigars, Salinger is a literate and subtle man and not disposed toward cornball humor and a folksy approach, one of them says. When I saw Lyndon having fun with Salinger and putting 10-gallon hats on him and so on, I just had a feeling Salinger wasn't going to wear that hat very long. Back in Washington, Johnson pushed him further. Soon there was circulating what Schlesinger calls a terrible story in which Johnson made Salinger eat a plate of bean soup at a White House luncheon out of pure delight in the exercise of authority. Prior to the ranch trip, during the first month after the assassination, Johnson and Salinger seemed to have developed a rapport. Of all the Kennedy people, the easygoing press secretary seemed to make the transition most easily, Schlesinger was to write. And that, as some long-time Johnson observers understood, was the problem. Having adopted Salinger, Johnson now treated him as if he were one of his veteran deputies, James Wexler was to write. And with such men, he does not worry about the amenities. After hearing the bean soup story, Schlesinger wrote in his journal that there is nothing more dangerous, so far as I can see, than being accepted by Johnson as one of his own. I think he has been meticulously polite to those in the White House whom he regards as Kennedy men. But when he starts regarding them as Johnson men, their day is over. He begins to treat them like Johnson men, which means like servants. That is what happened to Pierre Salinger. The rapport was gone, as became apparent to the men and women in the White House press lobby. Reporters every day saw numerous slight indications that he, Salinger, was not really as happy with the new regime as he said he was, one said. That analysis was correct. It was impossible for me to stay, and it was just a question of how I figured out how to get out of the White House, Salinger was to recall. And when Johnson noticed the unhappiness, tensions rose on both sides. The White House press operation deteriorated badly, as the Los Angeles Times put it. By February, Salinger was determined to resign. A Senate seat was opening in California, and the deadline for filing nominating petitions was March 20th. Early in March, Salinger decided to run. If lawyers could assure him that he was eligible for the seat, although he had been living in Virginia. He didn't mention his plans to Johnson, didn't give him any hint of them, even as the deadline approached. The lawyer's definitive answer, that he was indeed eligible, came through on March 19th, the very day before the deadline, while he was having lunch at the Sans Souci restaurant near the White House. And then, needing to be in California the next day to file his petition, he quit, virtually on the spot, in a resignation so abrupt as to be rude, one account called it, whose brusqueness made it one of the more startling in White House annals. Walking out of the restaurant, as he passed Ken O'Donnell sitting at another table, he told him, "I'm on my way to the president's office to resign." O'Donnell recalls that he almost fell out of my chair in surprise. Salinger went to the White House, arriving shortly after 3 o'clock, and went upstairs where Johnson was having a late lunch with a group of newspaper publishers and reporters in the family dining room. Encountering Jenkins and Moyers outside in the corridor, he told them that he needed to see the president as quickly as possible, and told the two startled men why. Moyers rang Johnson in the dining room. Picking up the phone at the head of a table lined with journalists, the president was told that his press secretary was just outside the door waiting to offer his resignation, which was to take effect that very afternoon. Johnson's self-possession didn't desert him for an instant. Not one of his luncheon guests, listening to his end of the conversation, had any idea what he was being told. Hanging up the phone, he resumed the lunch as if nothing had happened. And when, after the publishers left, he saw Salinger in the Oval Office at about 3:30, he was all graciousness, telling him he understood perfectly, and that if Salinger would write him a letter of resignation, he would answer it immediately. Despite the haste with which they were composed, the letters, which were exchanged in the Oval Office at 5 o'clock, met the requirements of the genre. Salinger's, telling the president, "What an honor it has been to serve you," offered his resignation with sincere regret and warm gratitude for your many and repeated kindnesses. And Johnson's accepted the resignation only with the greatest regret and with a reluctance that bows only to your strong personal desire to return to California. I hate to see you go. Then, in a gesture to reinforce the friendly tone, the president asked Salinger how much the California filing fee would be. $450 was the answer. And, pulling out a roll of bills, paid it, or at least part of it. He must have heard $250, Salinger was to say, saying, "Here's your first campaign contribution." "I had given LBJ very little time to consider my successor," Salinger was to write in his memoirs. Hardly an overstatement. When Johnson asked the press secretary who should succeed him, Salinger suggested Reedy because of the high regard in which he was held by the Washington Press Corps. Johnson told Jenkins to telephone Reedy and tell him to get over here. He's the new press secretary as of now. The president was therefore able to have an obviously well-qualified successor in place when Salinger, having returned it to his office, called in reporters and said he was resigning, effective immediately. And when articles about the surprise and startling resignation appeared the next day, Johnson made a trip to the press room to assure reporters that he was not disturbed at all about it. There was, however, no disguising the basic fact that the press secretary to the President of the United States had resigned, giving the president less than 2 hours' notice. Cleaning out his desk, Salinger drove to the airport, catching the 7 o'clock flight to San Francisco. With him on the flight was Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Hatcher, who, informed of the impending resignation, had told Salinger to announce his own at the same time you announce yours. "I'm going back to California with you." Salinger won the Democratic nomination for the California Senate seat and was appointed to the seat after the incumbent, Claire Engel, died on July 30, 1964, but was defeated in November by the Republican George Murphy. Writing in her diary that evening, Lady Bird was more frank. "A bombshell dropped into our lap this afternoon," she wrote. "Pierre Salinger walked into Lyndon's office and told him that he was going to resign. Of all the people from the Kennedy administration, I had felt that Salinger was one of the most professional, most committed to doing a job. Although he is very attached to the Kennedys, I thought we had established a certain simpatico relationship with him. So his sudden departure leaves a big uncertainty in my own thinking." But that was the last crack in the facade. None of John F. Kennedy's other staff members would resign during 1964. The biggest remaining names on that staff, O'Donnell, O'Brien, Dutton, Dungan, would still be in their White House offices when Lyndon Johnson ran for re-election that year, and when he won the presidency in his own right that November. With the single exception of Robert Kennedy, the faces around the cabinet table, McNamara, Rusk, Freeman, Udall, would be the same. Key advisers like McGeorge Bundy, like Walter Heller and Kermit Gordon, would still be at their desks. And even the loss of those three symbolic figures, Sorensen, Salinger, and Schlesinger, would not, in the event, have much significance. For in terms of the Johnson presidency, the crucial fact about the three men was that they, like Robert Kennedy, had stayed long enough. Lyndon Johnson had known that after the shock of his predecessor's assassination, America needed continuity, and that the key to continuity was that Kennedy men like Sorensen, Salinger, and Schlesinger stay in their jobs. And they had stayed, until, for Johnson's purpose, their leaving did little harm. By the time the three men left, short though that time was, the situation had changed. Continuity, keeping draped over the new administration the mantle of its predecessor, was no longer nearly as essential as it had been. By the time of Salinger's resignation, Washington had been reassured not merely by the continuance in office of members of the old administration, but by the performance in office of the new administration, of the new president. Discussing Salinger's resignation in the New York Times on March 20th, the day after it occurred, James Reston said it did not have the significance it would once have had. "While the nostalgic pretense of the first 3 months of the Johnson administration is vanishing, and the elaborate effort to prove that Boston loves Austin and vice versa is less apparent," he wrote, "the pretense was no longer necessary because People here are planning their lives on the assumption that the Johnson administration is going to be around for quite a while. The new administration wasn't going to be the same as the old one, Reston wrote, but that didn't mean it would be less effective, nor, in fact, that it might not be more effective. It is not clear who, among the Johnson staffers, Jenkins, Moyers, Valenti, or Reedy, will bring to the White House those useful commodities of vivid language, a sense of history, and, most important, a sense of humor, but Johnson himself will provide many other attributes, Reston wrote. He is effective precisely because he is so determined, industrious, personal, and even humorless, particularly in dealing with Congress. Kennedy, he wrote, retained an inordinate respect for the elders of the Congress. When they growled, he paused and often retreated. And he had a detached and even donnish willingness to grant the merit in the other fellow's argument. Johnson, he said, is not so inclined to retreat, and grants nothing in an argument, not even equal time. Ask not what you have done for Lyndon Johnson, but what you have done for him lately. This may not be the most attractive quality of the new administration, but it works. The lovers of style are not too happy with the new administration, but the lovers of substance are not complaining. By March 20th, of course, tangible evidence of Johnson's effectiveness was piling up. The passage of the tax cut, foreign aid, education and appropriations bills, the progress toward passage of the Civil Rights Bill. And along with these concrete successes was one less tangible, but just as impressive. The confidence engendered, not just in Washington, but in the country as a whole, by the aura of competence and determination that emanated from the White House. The confidence and success were documented in public opinion polls. In March, the country's most respected sampler of such opinion, the Gallup poll, asked Americans, "Do you approve or disapprove of the way Johnson is handling his job as president?" 73% of the respondents said they approved, an overwhelming percentage. In April, the figure would be 77%. Even more eloquent was the fact that of the respondents who did not approve, a small enough percentage in any case, the reason most gave for withholding their approval was not that they disapproved, but that they were undecided. In both March and April, months in which over 70% of the American people approved of the way Lyndon Johnson was handling the presidency, the percentage that disapproved was 9. The figures for April were 77% approval, 9% disapproval, 14% undecided. Americans of every political persuasion were united in approval. 2 out of 3 Republicans say that he is doing a good job as president, the poll reported. 77% to 9. Disapproval in a single digit. Every president, of course, enjoys a honeymoon period of high popularity after taking office, Gallup noted. Still, after the May poll showed similar results, Gallup stated that Johnson's approval rating was higher than any president or presidential candidate had rated in a comparable pre-election period since scientific polling techniques were developed. And the confidence and success were the theme in scores of newspaper columns in addition to Reston's. In the few short months since last November 22nd, America has watched Lyndon B. Johnson making Washington and the government his own, Joseph Alsop wrote. Acid tests still lay ahead, he wrote, but even the Kennedy men whom Mr. Johnson had not quite won over have no doubt that the acid tests will be successfully met when they come. Alsop, Johnson's Washington acquaintance of many years, had always been kindly disposed toward him. Marquis Childs had often, over the years, been extremely critical of him. Now Childs wrote that Lyndon Johnson is the most energetic and the most ambitious president to occupy the office in a very long time. His ambition is on a heroic scale. It is to unify the country, to resolve the fundamental differences between black and white, capital and labor, rich and poor, north and south. And Childs said, he believes he can do just this, and his confidence carries with it an added measure of strength. Strength attracts strength, and this is surely one explanation for his extraordinary standing in every indicator of public opinion. The public persona that had once made him an object of mockery had not disappeared, far from it. He was, at Georgetown dinner parties at least, The same Lyndon Johnson, Tom Wicker wrote. Once again he is being referred to as Old Cornpone. But now, suddenly, the corniness wasn't a drawback, Wicker said. Now, there is usually in the phrase a touch of awe and not infrequently a tone of respect. To paraphrase Lincoln on Grant, a good many people seem to believe it would be wise to find out what brand of corn he uses and send some to the other politicians. Cornpone it may be, but so long as Lyndon Johnson's evangelism comes from the heart, the nation is likely to get the message more often than not. Said Roscoe Drummond, the Johnson administration is getting more Johnsonian every day. He is just doing what comes naturally. The country likes it. He is throwing away most of the old rules about how to be president of the United States and making his own. In some of the columns, in fact, there was more than a touch of the awe Wicker mentioned. Lyndon Johnson resembles an elemental natural force of some hitherto undiscovered sort. An amiable force, to be sure, not destructive like an earthquake, but still a very powerful force that is only subject to its own natural rules, wrote Alsop. Awe, particularly when talking about the new president's legislative accomplishments. Johnson was managing, in a good deal less than a year, to get through Congress the two most important pieces of domestic legislation to be adopted in a quarter of a century. In a sense, the only important pieces of domestic legislation in that long period, Richard Rovere wrote in The New Yorker. It has been an astonishing performance, and one, it seems clear, that was beyond the reach of John F. Kennedy. Part of the explanation for Johnson's legislative success was the momentum generated behind Kennedy's proposals by his assassination, Rovere wrote. It seems necessary to believe that the gods of history are not above arranging things in such a way that a man may contribute more to the fulfillment of his ideals by being the victim of a senseless murder than by living and working for them. But part was something more, Rovere had to admit, grudging as were the words with which he acknowledged it. It is hardly possible to believe that a Texas draw, a strategic display of frugality, and some soft soaping of Senator Byrd can replace domestic discord with harmony. It seems necessary, though, to believe that such things can, for a time at least, go quite a long way toward promoting this sort of change, for a change has in fact occurred. The change, Rovere wrote, is reflected not only in the opinion polls, but in the graciousness and ease with which Senator Byrd and Representative Smith, the pair of Virginians who had been thwarting presidents almost, it seems, since time began, have been lending themselves to the designs of President Johnson. All. At the speed with which the accomplishments that went beyond the legislative, had been achieved. Recalling the people who in December were worried that Mr. Johnson would not have time enough before the election to put his own stamp on the country, Eric Severide said that the new president had had to accomplish three objectives to put the stamp there. He had to stamp his own leadership on his predecessor's administration, and this he did in a matter of days. He had to impress and beguile the Congress into a bill-passing frame of mind, and this he did in a matter of weeks. He had to imprint his own personality on the country at large, on a people just getting used to Mr. Kennedy's far different nature, and this Mr. Johnson began to do the moment propriety permitted. The tone of columnistic comparisons with his predecessor no longer contained even a touch of condescension. In fact, many of them conveyed a journalistic evaluation that the influential Reston put in a single succinct sentence. President Kennedy's eloquence was designed to make men think. President Johnson's hammer blows are designed to make men act. The magnitude of the success was apparent also in discussions about politics. By March 1964, speculation about the identity of the Republican nominee for president, about the merits and chances of Nelson Rockefeller, William Scranton, Richard Nixon, and Barry Goldwater, was the hot topic in political circles. By March, by the time Pierre Salinger quit, there was no speculation about the identity of the Democratic nominee. The last of that speculation was over. The Democratic nominee for president would be the man who was now president. There may have been doubts about that in December, but even among Robert Kennedy's most ardent supporters, there was no longer any doubt about that at all. And the president was going to be a hard man to beat in November's general election. Between March 13th and March 17th, Gallup polled Americans about Lyndon Johnson's chances against each of the most likely Republican nominees. If Barry Goldwater were the Republican candidate and Lyndon Johnson were the Democratic candidate, which would you like to see win? Gallup asked. 14% of the respondents said they would like to see Goldwater win. 78% said they would like Lyndon Johnson. The remaining 8% were undecided. For Goldwater,